morning and welcome to Sharper Iron. Spend the next hour with us studying the living and active Word of God, His two-edged sword of law and gospel, recorded for you in Holy Scripture, all about Jesus Christ, crucified, risen, and ascended for you. Thanks for tuning in this morning here on Worldwide KFUO, Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. I'm your host, Pastor Timothy Apple of Faith Lutheran Church in Godfrey, Illinois. Sharper Iron is underwritten by the Lutheran Church Extension Fund, where your investments help support the work of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Visit lcef.org for more information. On this Friday, June 21st, we are studying Esther chapter 2, verses 1 to 23. In today's text, the Persian king searches for a new queen, and among the group of women from which he is given to choose is a young Judean woman named Esther. Help us sharpen our faith in Christ as we study God's Word today. We have with us Pastor Peter Elliott. Pastor Elliott serves at Messiah Lutheran Church in Seattle, Washington. Pastor Elliott, welcome to Sharper Iron.
Thank you for having me.
It's a joy to have you with us today, Pastor. As we get started, give us some context. What should we know about the book of Esther? Bring us up to speed with anything that happened in chapter 1 that we need to know for chapter 2.
Well, as you know, the people of God went to Babylon in exile, and then the Persians conquered the Babylonians and allowed the Jews to go back home. So some Jews, a very small group, have gone back to Jerusalem and started to rebuild. But it seems like the vast majority are still living in the diaspora. They're living among other nations, including here in Persia. And the Persian king is a guy named Ahasuerus. In the Hebrew, Greek, it's Xerxes. It seems like both of these are butchering his actual name. His actual name was like, it was like Kishireshan. And so it seems like Hebrew people couldn't speak it. So they transliterated it in Greek. People couldn't speak it. I think Xerxes is the easiest one to say. So that's what I'm going to say.
That works. That works.
Yeah. So Xerxes is a son of Darius. His son will be Artaxerxes. And Xerxes is very, very famous. He actually leads a war to Greece right before our text in chapter 2. And this is the famous Battle of Thermopylae, where he fights the 300. He's off been doing that. Very famous story also in that war is when he gets to the body of water that separates Turkey from Greece. It's called the Hellespont. He builds this pontoon bridge, and the first one gets destroyed by a storm. And so he flogs the Hellespont. He orders his soldiers to flog the body of water 300 times to punish it. And then he rebuilds his pontoon bridge and goes across. So he's just kind of that kind of guy, full of hubris, arrogant. And he's retreated back from Greece and that the failed. And we don't really know why he came back. It could have been there was a riot in Babylon. But he comes back. And we get to chapter 2, and he remembers, oh, yeah, I have to replace that queen Vashti. So when it says he remembered, it's probably when he got back from war.
Okay.
He says, yeah, I got to get a new wife.
So in between chapters 1 and 2, there is some of that historical background that we know from secular sources about the reign of King Xerxes of Ahasuerus, as we'll read here in Esther chapter 2. And so all of that is in the background after these things, as you said, the events of chapter 1, where Queen Vashti was disciplined for her bad behavior, in scare quotes there, that Xerxes did not like. This is remembered by the king here after these things. That delay has to do with some of the political machinations happening throughout his empire, particularly against the Greeks. We come back now to his more personal life, which is the background for the book of Esther. So we're in Esther chapter 2. Anything more background-wise before we jump into the text?
No, I think that's probably enough.
All right. So Esther chapter 2, this is the text beginning at verse 1. After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had abated, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's young men who attended him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa the capital, under custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women. Let their cosmetics be given them." and the young and let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. This pleased the king, and he did so. Now there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjaminite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. He was bringing up Hadassah, that is, Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at, and when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and when many young women were gathered in Susa the citadel in custody of Hegai, Esther also was taken into the king's palace and put in custody of Hegai, who had charge of the women. And the young woman pleased him and won his favor. And he quickly provided her with her cosmetics and her portion of food, and with 7 chosen young women from the king's palace, and advanced her and her young women to the best place in the harem. Esther had not made known her people or kindred, for Mordecai had commanded her not to make it known. And every day Mordecai walked in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and what was happening to her. Now, when the turn came for each young woman to go in to King Ahasuerus, after being 12 months under the regulations for the women, since this was the regular period of their beautifying, 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with spices and ointments for women, when the young woman went in to the king in this way, she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening she would go in, and in the morning she would return to the second harem in custody of Shaasgaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She would not go into the king again, unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name. When the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his own daughter, to go into the king, she asked for nothing except what Hegai, the king's eunuch, who had charge of the women, advised. Now Esther was winning favor in the eyes of all who saw her. And when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus, into his royal palace, in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign, the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave a great feast for all his officials and servants. It was Esther's feast. He also granted a remission of taxes to the provinces and gave gifts with royal generosity. Now, when the virgins were gathered together the second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Esther had not made known her kindred or her people, as Mordecai had commanded her, for Esther obeyed Mordecai just as when she was brought up by him. In those days, as Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, 2 of the king's eunuchs, who guarded the threshold, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And this came to the knowledge of Mordecai, and he told it to Queen Esther, and Esther told the king in the name of Mordecai. When the affair was investigated and found to be so, the men were both hanged on the gallows, and it was recorded in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. That's our text for today, Esther chapter 2, verses 1 to 23. Pastor Elliot, we've set the context already. We know where we are in history with King Xerxes Ahasuerus again, and he's come back after this campaign against the Greeks. He remembers what's gone on with Vashti, and there's this competition of sorts to replace her. And this is perhaps a little bit foreign to the way that kings take queens today, the way that rulers take wives today. So let's dig into some background here. What's going on in the overarching scheme of things in this chapter?
Yeah. You know, God warned his people through Samuel in the time when they asked for a king, what kings were going to be like. You know, kings are going to take all your daughters. They're going to take your sons as soldiers. They're going to take all your wealth. And here you have a classic earthly king, Xerxes, taking women as if they're, you know, prizes to be had, objectifying them. So what it seems like from the text is he's got 2 harems. He's got a harem of betrothed virgins, virgins that he has marked for himself, and they go through 12 months of beautification. It seems like that beautification is to do with skin lightening and skin softening, also to make them fragrant and clean, and it seems also to plump them up. They have standards of beauty that skinny means you're poor, you know, thicker means you're rich. So it seems like he does these 12 months with these virgins that are marked off for him. And then they come to him for one night. He consummates the marriage. And then they go to a second house where the second harem is, where his wives are, concubines. And it says in the text that unless he called you back by name, that was the one night you ever met your husband. So they get one night with him, and if they please him, they might see him again. But yeah, it's a very different situation than a godly marriage. It's quite awful and offensive. And often people, when they read this, they're offended by it. And it's like, well, good, you should be. The Bible's not condoning this. It's right. Describing what a pagan king does. It's not you know, supporting it. In fact, Xerxes looks bad in this book. He's a drunk. He's angry. He needs simple advice from advisors. We know from history that he's full of arrogance and hubris. His own people want to kill him at the end of the chapter. So,
right.
It's not supporting Xerxes.
Sure. Yeah. And I think that that's an important thing to keep in mind, especially with where we are in the book of Esther, where Xerxes really has been the main character up to this point. He's, it seems, maybe directing things. But as we find out, as the narrative progresses, we know in the background who really is directing things. This is the Lord. And he's going to work through even a man like Xerxes. Talk a little bit. So you mentioned, just to make sure I got this so far, the first harem, which it seems is under the leadership of Haggai, not Haggai the prophet, but Haggai the eunuch. There's a second harem, it sounds like, as well, under the, and talk about pronunciations, Shashgaz, something like that.
Yeah.
What's that about?
Well, you know, you have these eunuchs guard the women because, you know, they don't have desires and so often those high up in the government, especially those that were going to be around your wives, were eunuchs. And so, yeah, he's in charge of keeping them under lock and key, you know, keeping them guarded and pure. And all the, there's also this issue that one wife gets to be the queen, the head wife, which probably means the heir will come from her. So all these concubines, they're all hoping to win this competition to be the chief wife, because then they're more significant and their son will inherit something. And so it's a weird situation. Often in the Bible, when they talk about the queen, it's actually the queen mother, but here in Esther, the queen is the chief of the wives.
Right. And that becomes plain. And as we'll see and talk about in a moment, Esther becomes that queen due again to the Lord's work in the background of all of this. Before we leave that whole thought behind, and just the way that you mentioned this section of Esther and other things that happen in this regard with King Xerxes and his harem of wives, how it's offensive to us. You said, well, just because the Bible mentions something doesn't mean that it condones something. So maybe just talk a little more broadly from this text then about the ways that we do see marriage being abused here, and perhaps the ways that, although we find it offensive, we maybe haven't gotten so much better as we think we have.
Yeah, right. In the beginning, God made them male and female, right? Adam and Eve is the design, and Xerxes is not living according to God's design. And he cares little for her. Women in U.S. culture, I think, compared to historic standards, have been treated well. I think, and if you study U.S. history, women compared to historical standards have been treated with dignity and respect and value, and have been appreciated for their intelligence and skills, and encouraged to go to get educated, you know, educated at university. And sometimes you have to ask yourself, well, why? Why is that? And I think a lot of that is because of our Christian past, that Christians value women, that they are made in the image of God. They are those, knit in the womb by God, those for whom Christ died and shed his blood. So women, and also, I should mention, children have a lot of value and worth in Christian societies, but that's not something we should assume. In many societies, women and children don't have that kind of value. You know, in a lot of Islamic societies, we see issues. And even as we go into kind of paganism or you might say hedonism, as our culture kind of slips into those things, I think you see more objectification of women. I think nowadays you're seeing this trend where if a guy is rich and handsome, he sleeps with a lot of women, you know, gets on one of these dating apps and kind of abuses women in the way of serial fornication. So, you know, nothing has really changed. Human nature is still human nature. And when men get power, like Xerxes, men tend to do these kinds of evil acts. I was talking to my brother about this chapter, and he joked that it's The Bachelor, Sousa edition, that there's not much difference between watching The Bachelor and watching what Xerxes is doing here.
Yeah.
And so we like to think that we're so beyond this, but we still often treat women as objects of sexual gratification.
Yeah. I think what you said earlier about, you know, if this offends you, good, it should. And it should offend you because it does go against what the Lord gives as a good thing in marriage, as you said, going all the way back to Genesis 1 and 2, which he then protects in the sixth commandment. So that if a text like this offends you, or if a show like The Bachelor offends you, then go into the scriptures, read what God does give in marriage, and return to that, cling to that, rather than reacting against the abuses that you see here and going too far in a different direction into different abuses. Allow the offense that you would see against marriage to compel you back toward the good gift that God gives of marriage as he reveals it into the scripture, in the scriptures.
Yeah. Thanks be to God that Jesus is a better king than Xerxes and a better husband than Xerxes.
That's right. Okay. So that helps us to understand, you know, what's going on in the background of this entire chapter as Xerxes is attempting to replace Vashti as his queen. So in the midst of this, again, Xerxes has kind of been the main player so far in the book of Esther, and the Persian Empire is the setting. But in the midst of this, here in chapter 2, we now actually start to meet the main characters, humanly speaking. And they're first introduced in chapter 5. We meet a man by the name of Mordecai. He's said to be a Jew living in Susa, and we get a little bit of his genealogy. The genealogies that we have here in Esther and the names are not as extensive as we just got finished reading in Ezra and Nehemiah. But anytime we come across names, it's maybe worth at least a few minutes to pause and consider who these people are and why they might be mentioned, especially since it's kind of brief. So we've got Mordecai is called the son of Jair, son of Shimei, son of Kish, and that's all to tell that he's a Benjaminite. What might we be learning about Mordecai from that brief genealogy?
Yeah. Now, these three names of his given, Jair, Shimei, Kish, these could be the three most immediate generations. But when he gives three generations like this, usually it's giving three significant generations. And Shimei and Kish are famous Benjamites. And so arguably, this is saying that Mordecai is from the famous Shimei and the famous Kish from the clan. Shimei, if you remember, he's the one who opposed David. I think it was during the Absalom's rebellion, if I remember right. And then Solomon, David gives instructions concerning this guy to Solomon after he dies. And then Kish is where it all starts, because Kish is Saul's father. So that's what, you know, most famous Benjamite. So he's from this line of Saul. Now, what's really significant here is the next chapter begins and says that the antagonist, Haman, is an Agagite. And Agag is the archenemy of Saul. And so you see these two families have fought down through history. Sort of the first big battle is in the book of Exodus 17, after the Red Sea. The Amalekites attack the Israelites, and that's the story where they hold up Moses' arms during the battle, fighting the Amalekites. You also get Amalekites joining the Midianites in the Gideon story. So Gideon fights these guys. Then Saul This is Saul's big task. He's supposed to wipe out the Amalekites and Agag. And if you remember, Saul fails to do it. Now, if Saul would have obeyed God, this story would never have had to happen, right? Hammond wouldn't exist. But Saul doesn't wipe out Agag and doesn't wipe out the elites of the empire. He spares them. And Samuel famously hacks Agag to pieces.
Right.
So this story, way down, you see that these two families are still fighting and the consequences of Saul's rebellion. And here you've got Mordecai, a Benjamite, versus Haman and Agagite. And you should know where this is headed, this town isn't big enough for the two of us kind of thing.
Sure. Yeah. So those details that you're bringing out just from the three, again, likely the famous names that are attached to these three that are mentioned, I think help us to see a little more clearly what's going on just in this chapter. We're finding out a lot of information at this point in the book of Esther, but it's not always entirely plainly clear as to, like, why. Why do I need to know who Mordecai is? Why do I need to know his background? Why do I need to know about this matter with Xerxes' queen and his competition to replace her? Why do I need to find out, as we'll find out, this little conspiracy that Mordecai uncovers? There's a lot of background information that we're getting in these chapters that's setting up what is to come.
Yeah. The book often kind of seems random, coincidence at first, but then you get towards the end and you realize there are no coincidences. That even though God's not mentioned in this book, God is clearly behind all this, protecting his people, thwarting the foe, putting Mordecai and Esther at the right place at the right time in order to prevent a Holocaust in the end. So, it does seem random, and yet all these threads get pulled together.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's where, with the book of Esther being, you know, very famous in the scriptures for not actually mentioning God by name, we don't actually hear about God as one of the characters in the book of Esther explicitly, but seeing all of this background information that's laid out so carefully, again, in ways that maybe don't make sense to us if we're reading through it the first time through, but by the end of it, when you see how it does come together, where a non-Christian might look at that and say, well, that's a really strange coincidence. For the Christian reader, in the context of the revelation God has given in the scriptures, we are able to see that even though he's not been named as a, quote, character in the narrative, God is the one at work in history in the book of Esther.
Amen.
All right, so we've met Mordecai as a son of Jair, son of Shimei, Kish, a Benjaminite. Very famous background there that's going to help lay the groundwork for who he is. What else do we know about this Mordecai from here and from history?
Yeah, so first of all, his name is probably from Marduk, which is the chief god of Babylon. Now, that doesn't mean that his parents worshiped this false god. You know, sometimes this happens where someone, like, for instance, Diana. Diana's a false god, but nowadays we're just kind of used to it, you know?
Right.
So he's probably named after Marduk. So his family probably has assimilated. Now, famously, we know that the Jews were carried off in 586. Zedekiah was crushed. Jerusalem was burned. Jeremiah had to watch it, 586. These guys were deported 11 years prior, in 597. And it's actually that deportation where King Jeconiah is deported. That's the lineage of Christ. And it's actually those people where God promises to build a remnant. There's not much hopefulness for the 586 crowd, but the 597 crowd, these guys, God said that he was going to rebuild, restore, and return them back home. Very famous Jeremiah 29:11. I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Well, well, that includes Esther, right? God knows how he's going to spare his people, even though he's taken them to Babylon. And if you read Jeremiah 29, God's very clear that they're going to be there for at least 70 years.
Right.
So God says, because you're going to be there for 70 years, marry, give your children to marriage, build homes, bless the city, seek the welfare of the city, for in its welfare, you'll find your welfare. And so that's what the Jews were focused on. They were actually focused on being a blessing to Babylonian culture. And then when the Persians conquered, then to the Persians. And so it seems like Mordecai is one of these people. Now, that deportation, 597, that wasn't everybody. That was the elites. That was the best and the brightest. You know, the smiths, craftsmen, politicians, I mean, the lawyers, these kind of people. So Mordecai is probably from a kind of a wealthier family, significant family. And he's made a home here in Persia now, in Susa. And he's assimilated into their culture, so much so that they don't know he's a Jew. And Esther, she at least has some Jewish blood. Maybe she's, you know, they've intermarried, who knows, but they're able to kind of blend in. So that's kind of significant.
Sure. Yeah. And we see how Mordecai in this chapter instructs Esther not to be forthright with that at this moment in the story, which again, that's setting up more to come, what the Lord's up to. I appreciate the way that you give us the background of the deportation that the family of Mordecai is a part of, that it comes from the one with Jeconiah, the middle one. You have the one where Daniel and his three friends, they are exiled in about 605 BC. Then you get the prophet Ezekiel in that middle one that we're talking about here, 597 BC. And then the prophet Jeremiah is the one who, he's not actually taken to Babylon, but he's a part of that last one in the 587, 586 BC. The fact that we're in the middle one, which again, very, very significant, scripturally speaking, that this is where the promised line goes, that Mordecai's family comes from there, again, allows us to see who's at work in the background. This is the Lord at work through the family of Mordecai, even there as an exile still in Susa. We're going to keep looking at this text and talk more about Mordecai and Esther on the other side of the break. You're listening to Sharper Iron on KFUO. We're talking to Pastor Peter Elliott this morning. We'll be right back. Please stick around.
Lutheran Church Extension Fund exists to support Lutheran Church Missouri Synod ministries and church workers. How do we do this? Your investment with LCEF makes it possible for LCMS churches, schools, organizations, and church workers to receive low-cost loans for new and growing ministries. And faithful Lutherans like you, church members and church workers alike, make that possible when you invest with LCEF. Learn more at lcef.org.
LCF is a nonprofit religious organization. Therefore, LCF investments are not FDIC-insured bank deposit accounts. This is not an offer to sell investments or solicitation to buy. LCF will offer and sell its securities only in states where authorized. The offer is made solely by LCF's offering circular. Investors should carefully read the offering circular, which more fully describes associated risks.
Welcome back to Sharper Iron. It is Friday, June 21st. We're studying Esther chapter 2, verses 1 to 23 with Pastor Peter Elliott. He serves at Messiah Lutheran Church in Seattle, Washington. Pastor Elliott, prior to the break, we were talking about Mordecai. He is from an important line. His lineage provides a bit of foreshadowing as to the conflict that's going to come in the book of Esther. The fact that he is part of a family that is exiled along with Jeconiah is a reminder of the promised Christ. And when we find out about who he's related to right here and right now, we find out in verse 7 that he is raising Hadassah, more commonly known as Esther. That's who the book is named after. Esther is the daughter of Mordecai's uncle. So Esther and Mordecai are cousins. Mordecai is raising his younger cousin, presumably younger, because her parents have died already. Talk to us about just the role of Mordecai as the one who provides for, protects, and raises Esther.
Yeah. One thing that just came to my mind is, you know, God's often called the God of widows and orphans. And true religion is to care for the widows and orphans. And here, Mordecai, he knows an orphan. His younger cousin, who's an orphan, and so he adopts her. And I think he's a beautiful picture of a good father. You know, all good fathers are a reflection of God the Father, who gives us every good and perfect gift. And here we see Mordecai being a good father, protecting her as well as he can, providing for her. And also just, I really like that he just pays attention to her. I love verse 11. Every day, right, without fail, every day, Mordecai walked in front of the court of the harem, walks at the gate of the building to learn how Esther was and what was happening to her. He doesn't even get to see her. He just wants to maybe hear a report about her. But every day he goes there because he has that level of concern for her. And I think that's a beautiful example. You know, I've always admired, older gentleman who's maybe wife's in a dementia ward, but he goes and visits her every day and loves her and talks to her. And that, you know, that's just a beautiful thing to have a man who cares so much that he is listening and paying attention and desiring to help. And this is such a contrast with Xerxes, right? Xerxes, for him, women are disposable. It's you know, use them during the night, and then you move on. And Mordecai, obviously, this isn't a sexual relationship, but Mordecai does, you know, cares deeply for her, and is interested in helping her every need. So definitely this contrast between Mordecai's love and Xerxes' objectification.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in Xerxes' objectification, I think, you know, Mordecai is trying to make the best of a very awful situation that Esther's been put into. The way that I read the text is that Esther has been, for lack of another word, conscripted into this harem mm-hmm. of women. It wasn't something that she chose for herself or that Mordecai chose for her, but she's been conscripted to be a part of this competition to win the spot of queen for Xerxes. And Mordecai is trying to make the best of that with the situation that he's been given. So almost, not that, I don't know if you would say that Xerxes is his enemy in that sense, but he's maybe not high on Mordecai's list, which is going to, I think, become important as we get to the end of the chapter and what Mordecai actually does for Xerxes. But he's trying to make the best of a bad situation and shows that care, concern to the utmost for his cousin Esther, whom he's raising.
Yeah, agreed.
So let's talk a little bit more then about with Mordecai and what's going on between him and Esther. He instructs her to not say anything about her lineage at this point. And I'm the reason this struck my attention, not only because it's there in the text, but recently on Sharper Iron, we've read Daniel, Ezra, and Nehemiah, books that all deal with, in some aspect, God's people living among foreigners, as we see there. And one thing I noted about, especially Daniel and his three friends, and also Nehemiah and Ezra as well, is that they tend to be very faithful and unafraid of the fact that they are the people of God living in a foreign land. And when their nationality or their faith is challenged, you know, Daniel says, throw me in the lion's den. The three friends say, throw me in the fiery furnace. And here Mordecai instructs Esther not to say anything about her background. And I, on the one hand, I certainly don't want to cast a negative light where there isn't one. But on the other hand, I also know that the scriptures aren't afraid of showing us the realities of sinful people. And I'm wondering about their actions in hiding their background at this point, as say in comparison or contrast with men like Daniel and his three friends. If you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, we do know that the Persians had a lot of like national pride in their ethnicity. So I think there was actually some kind of rule that you could only marry a Persian. The king could only marry Persians. And so there could be something going on there that he doesn't want her to get in trouble. It also could be just he has foresight, because as the next chapter begins, an enemy of the Jews rises in prominence. Maybe Mordecai already kind of knows that that's going to happen. Maybe he knows that this enemy of the Jews is rising in prominence. And so it's just not a good time to let people know you're a Jew. It's kind of like before World War I, it was not a good time to let everyone know you were a German in America. You know, sure. That was the era where Lutherans were telling their kids, you're not a German, you're an American.
Sure.
And so I think probably Mordecai reads the cultural moment and knows that it's not a popular time to be a Jew.
Sure. And I guess I'm not trying to say that he's somehow acting in a in a faithless way by giving her that instruction. And maybe the way to read it is, this is him being, you know, as Jesus even says, wise as serpents. So exercising that human wisdom, which we certainly saw Nehemiah exercise, or he will actually, historically speaking, he comes after Esther. But as we've read recently, Nehemiah exercised that human wisdom and makes his move for with Artaxerxes and the request that he lays, he does it at the right time. So maybe that's the way we should understand Mordecai's instructions here, is he's not inviting the persecution when it's not necessary. Perhaps not that he would have, you know, if he'd been questioned, are you a member of God's people? I like to think he would say yes, but since that question's not being asked, there's not a need to make that absolutely public at this moment. When the time comes, they will be unafraid to be recognized as the people of God. Maybe.
Well, Mordecai is actually called Mordecai the Jew later. So I don't think it's, I think it's actually less of Mordecai hiding his own identity.
Sure.
He's hiding Esther's.
Esther's.
So I think, right. I think people know who Mordecai is, but they don't know that Esther is Jewish.
Sure. And it's not the time for that connection to be laid out at this moment in the book. That'll come. That'll come, especially in chapters 4 and following, as we'll see. And just one more thought, because this is kind of where my mind was taking me on that line of thought. Even if there is an element of fear on Mordecai or Esther's part at this point, and a fear that would be a sinful sort of fear, that doesn't prevent the Lord from being at work, even through the sins of people. We see him at work through the faithfulness of his people. We see him at work through the faithlessness of his people. And that was really kind of where my mind was going, if there is any of that in the background here.
It's possible. I took it as he's being a protective father.
Sure.
And so he's not worried about his own risk, but he's worried about hers. And he thinks that it would be unwise for her to let people know.
Sure. Sure. And I'm good with that. But I appreciate the conversation. I don't want to belabor the point anymore, but I do appreciate that back and forth. So let's talk more about Esther then. She is going to become one of the main players here in the text. And it starts here with her role in, again, in this harem, this competition to become the next queen. It seems that pretty quickly she distinguishes herself, or maybe not that she distinguishes herself, but becomes distinguished in the sight of others. Talk about the way that this happens for Esther.
Well, we know she's beautiful, but it does seem that there must be something more going on, because probably all these women are beautiful, that she is winning favor in the sight of all. So it seems like she has an inner beauty as well. And it struck me that the idea of winning favor in the sight of all, how often that comes in the scriptures. You know, Joseph wins favor with Pharaoh in the end of Genesis. Daniel wins favor through his wisdom. Jesus definitely with a lot of the Galilean peasants and Decapolis. You know, all these men had people that hated them, but they were hated due to people being jealous, or because they're teaching, you know, but as far as their life and their compassion and their kindness and wisdom, they were admired by many. And then I thought about, you know, just being a pastor and applying this to my own life, how pastors are called to be above reproach. And it says in 1 Timothy 3 that not only are we to be above reproach, but well thought of by outsiders. And so, Esther is not a bull in the china shop going into the harem and making a fuss, but she's making the best of the situation, and she's got a good reputation. And so you kind of have to read between the lines, because we don't have much detail of what happened that year in the harem, but she must have been a noble character, living out her faith. Because she becomes admired by the eunuchs watching over her and others. So,
Yeah. And I think when you, again, put this text into the context of all those other ones that we have from the scriptures that you were mentioning, again, you see how the Lord is at work here, just like we know, especially from maybe the Joseph account, because you get at the end of that Joseph's interpretation that what was being used for evil by people, the Lord was working for good. I think that helps to provide a helpful background for what's going on here with Esther. What Xerxes intends for, you know, his own personal pleasure, the Lord is actually going to work for good. And just these little notes about Esther finding favor and the way that, again, what might otherwise look like coincidence, we as Christians look and see the providence, the hand of God at work to accomplish his purposes for his people. Talk a little bit more about that reality that is not only evident in this text, but really throughout the book of Esther.
Yeah, you know, God uses all sorts of things for his purposes. God uses our place in life, the nation we live in, the languages we know. He uses our talents, our abilities. God, which he, by the way, he gives us. So it's not like God just kind of walks upon us and has to figure it out. No, God actually gives us these things, that he supplies these things. Now, I think about Ephesians 2:10, that we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for the good works he's prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. And God had prepared good works for Esther. And preparing her for those good works, one of the things he gave her was beauty. And that beauty wasn't accidental. The beauty was for God's glory. So we don't always understand these things. Why does God make us the way we are? Why does God put us in the family that he puts us, in the nation he puts us, the language we know? Why? And sometimes we know in hindsight. In Esther's story, we're going to know in hindsight exactly why God made her the way he made her. But often we don't know. Often maybe we won't know until the last day. Maybe God will show us exactly why he made us the way he made us. But definitely we get to see in this story God's plan for Esther. And part of that plan was to make her beautiful. To make her beautiful on the outside and to make her beautiful on the inside, so that she had the sort of reputation where she could have the boldness to approach Xerxes later in the story and oppose the antagonist Haman. So God works all things for good. Why does she get to be beautiful? Well, it's not for her own good. It's actually for the saving of the Jews and specifically the lineage of the Christ, that she's beautiful for a purpose.
Right. So for us then, as readers of this text and seeking to live as Christians here in 2024, sounds like part of what we can take from this text is to, trust God as life comes to us, or maybe as he gives life to us, to trust him to be at work. And we may not ever see how things fit together, and we don't even really need to know how all things fit together to live faithfully in the moment, the day that God has given with whatever he's placed before us, to simply, as you quote from Ephesians 2, to walk in those good works that he's putting in front of us. This is the faithful response of the Christian, and then to trust that he's going to work that out for the good of his people, for our own good in his own time. That seems to be the response of Mordecai and Esther in Esther chapter 2, and a way that we could live faithfully now as Christians in our day and age.
Yeah. The big famous line in Esther, which you'll get to in chapter 4, it's 4:14. Mordecai says, "Who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this?"
Right.
So that Mordecai he's on to God. Like, I see what you're up to, God. Perhaps this is all his hand.
Yeah.
That he has put Esther in this place, in this time, given her this beauty, this personality to accomplish this task, which he is going to perform through her.
Yeah. Well, and not to steal too much thunder from that conversation when we get to chapter 4, but maybe as we think about it here in chapter 2, where it's veiled, at least if we're just reading through this the very first time, with what Mordecai says there, who knows? The reality is, in Esther chapter 2, he doesn't know. Maybe he does have some, a particular gift of wisdom, and he's kind of seeing things fall into place, but he doesn't actually know in Esther chapter 2, nor does Esther. But even apart from knowing, they don't have to. They can still live faithfully in that moment where God has placed them. Here I am in the harem of Xerxes. What do I do? How do I live faithfully? and try to live faithfully right then, even if you don't know or ever know what's going to happen, you can live faithfully at that moment.
Yeah. When you said we don't know, I thought about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego when he said, our God can save us. And even if he doesn't.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. You know, they actually don't know if God's going to save them. But so maybe Mordecai thinks, hey, maybe God's using this for our salvation. But even if he doesn't, God's still good. And he's got our best interest in mind.
Let's talk a little bit more about Esther and the way that she acts. We've talked a little bit more about Mordecai. Talk about the way that we see her and her faith as it lived out here.
Yeah. This is an argument from silence, but I think it's notable that we don't have her complaining. Mm. We don't have her, you know, saying, why me? Why do I have to be married to this horrible guy? She's not complaining. She seems to quietly trust in God. And she honors her father. You could also argue that she honors her emperor.
Yeah.
And so there's this beautiful verse where it says, Esther had not made known her kindred or her people, just as Mordecai had commanded her. For Esther obeyed Mordecai just as when she was brought up by him. Mm. So she continues to keep the fourth commandment after marriage. Now, I don't want to overemphasize this because there is a sense in which we leave father and mother and hold fast to our spouse and the two become one flesh, you know, and that the relationship between child and parent does change through marriage. But I think Esther is a great example of the fourth commandment being a lifelong commandment and a beautiful, you know, even though she's now basically a queen or about to be a queen, she's on her way to being a queen. She's still honoring her father. And so, you know, if you go read the commands in the New Testament about faithful women, like 1 Peter 2 and 3, you know, Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, and you are her children. If you don't fear anything that's frightening, you know, Esther is a great example of that. You know, she's in a very scary situation, but she seems to trust the Lord. She seems to honor her husband, even though he doesn't deserve it. She honors Mordecai, who does deserve it. And so she just has this kind of quiet faithfulness.
Yeah. And so what we see perhaps by way of silence here will be made more evident as the narrative progresses, and we'll see the character and the faith of Esther more fully as we see the way that she acts, again, in relationship both to Mordecai and Xerxes. Now, as the text concludes in chapter 2, having come to a conclusion in terms of now Esther is queen instead of Vashti, the king even, it sounds like, throws a feast in Esther's honor. Feasts are very important in the book of Esther, and you get apparently a holiday from taxes, some sort of national holiday to celebrate the new queen. After that, we find out more about Mordecai and his role there in Susa. And this is another one of those moments where you're kind of wondering, okay, this is fine to know. How's it going to come into play? We just have to keep these last few verses of chapter 2 in mind so that we understand things that are to come. This is another key piece of the puzzle that's being laid out that we will see come together. As you put it, another thread that's being laid there that will be woven together at another point in the book of Esther. So talk to us about what happens in verses 19 to 23 and Mordecai and what he does for Xerxes.
Yeah. Well, first of all, you know, kind of why is he there? Why is he at this gate? Well, he always comes to the gate to visit Esther, right? So that's why he's there. So his love puts him in the right place at the right time. And God uses that. He's seeking the welfare of Persia. You know, he's honoring his emperor, who is also sort of his son-in-law. funny enough, right?
Right.
There's definitely a power imbalance there.
Yeah.
But he does, you know, he does the right thing, you know, in guarding his king's life. You know, there might be a little bit of temptation here to say, like, why say anything? Like, you know, Xerxes is sort of a Hitler character. Like, why not just let Hitler get assassinated? And I think some people have argued kind of this way, but that's not how the text takes this at all. In the text, there's no hesitation. It's for Mordecai. It's the right thing to do to honor the emperor, protect his king's life. And he doesn't seem to want to be repaid. He doesn't get paid, and he doesn't complain or anything, though he will be repaid later in the story and thanked because Xerxes forgets to thank him. But you know, why say anything? One thing to consider is that not only do I think Mordecai is doing this to keep the fourth commandment, but I think also Mordecai realizes that regime change is dangerous.
Sure.
You know, we're used to peaceful transition of power, but back in the ancient world, regime change is a dangerous time, especially for someone in the palace like Esther. And the next king might be worse. There's no guarantee you get rid of Xerxes and the next guy's better. So there's no real reason to get rid of Xerxes because there's kind of no hope of improvement. And so I think there's a realization not only that in the keeping of the fourth commandment and of honoring his emperor, but also just realizing that this is a dangerous situation for everybody. And so he reports it. It's a thankless good work, but it gets recorded in the national records, and that's going to show up later in the story.
Yeah, that's right.
And one little final note is this gallows. This is not important at all, but it says gallows in ESV, which, you know, would be like a hangman noose. Some people think it was more like crucifixion, but probably the most likely is actually the Persians impaled people. And so all these times where it says gallows in the ESV, my thinking is it's probably a spike is what it is.
Hmm.
And so you can see how brutal the Persians were.
Sure. Yeah. Which is pretty typical of execution in the ancient world. It wasn't intended to be painless. It was intended to be painful and to set an example. Don't do what this guy did. So yeah, impaled on a stake is probably the picture in our minds of what happens here. And later as we go forward, as you mentioned, the fact that it gets written down is also a very important detail, which would be easy for us to gloss over, but it's a very important detail that will come up again. As we noted already, even though, again, historically, the books of Ezra and Nehemiah come later in history, this record-keeping of the Persians pays off in a number of instances for God's people. It paid off in the days of Nehemiah when they were able to look back and say, oh yeah, Cyrus did say that this place could be rebuilt. Again, the record-keeping of the Persians is an important thing, and once again, we should see the hand of God at work here. Pastor Elliot, we've got about 2 minutes here on the morning. Help us to wrap things up and see, again, God at work here in Esther chapter 2.
Yeah, and if you're a secretary for a church council, we thank you for your record keeping.
That's right.
Yeah. No, Mordecai's got no idea how God's going to use this, but he just does the good that God has given him for the day, right? When his uncle died, he saw the need, and he loved and adopted. When she gets seized as a virgin harem, he visits her every day. When he's there visiting her every day, he hears of this plot and he does the right thing. You know, Mordecai, he doesn't see how this is all going to come together, but he fears God and he keeps the commandments, as we hear at the end of Ecclesiastes, right? This is the aim of man. You fear God, you keep the commandments. And we see that in Mordecai. Mordecai is a very noble character, and so is Esther. And so there's a lot to be admired in them and emulated in them.
Yes. Yeah. And the Lord makes use of his people, even when they don't realize what he is up to. He does make use of the good works that he has prepared for them to do, as we will see as the book of Esther continues. Pastor Peter Elliot serves at Messiah Lutheran Church in Seattle, Washington. He's been helping us today to study Esther chapter 2, verses 1 to 23. Pastor Elliot, thanks for being our guest today.
Yep. Great to be here.
I'm your host on Sharper Iron, Pastor Timothy Apple of Faith Lutheran Church in Godfrey, Illinois. If you have any questions about Esther chapter 2, send an email to kfuo@kfuo.org. It is always a joy to hear from you. Join us next week on Monday to study Esther chapter 3 to see how the Lord continues to work in the background for the good of his people, making use of Esther and Mordecai. Thanks for spending the morning with us today. Talk to you again next week. We'll be right back.
Showing support for KFUO is now easier than ever. You can sport a KFUO shirt, swag, or even socks by visiting our online store. Go to KFUO.org/store and order high-quality KFUO-branded merch. You no longer need to wait for our annual share-a-thon for a chance to show your KFUO spirit. Visually share and wear this ministry out in the world by checking out our selection. Every purchase helps to support our proclamation of Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. Go to KFUO.org/store.